maybe, just maybe, the end is in sight for the global health crisis. But across the world, billions of people stand exposed to the economic fallout from this terrible pandemic. Workers on the front line have been heaped with praise through the course of this crisis, and many of them are migrants, often working in difficult, super exploited conditions. But vast numbers have also returned home, and with the costs of travel to many states now extortionate due to the mandatory hotel quarantine system, many are effectively stuck, unable to return home, even in an emergency situation. Meanwhile, our government continues its culture war offensive, desperate to find a scapegoat and pretend all is well. So today we ask, what is it like to be a migrant in Britain in 2021? And shed a light on the quiet struggles underway for human dignity in a post-COVID world.
COVID-19 is no respecter of equality.
Doctors and nurses are on the front lines of this war.
Industries have been functioning mainly because of the migrant workers.
Capitalism is out of control right now.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. We're joined today by Zoe Gardner from the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants and Elena Ivanova from the Another Europe office. We talk about protecting migrant rights as Brexit unfolds and the economic crisis deepens. You can feedback to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. Hope you enjoy it.
Zoe Gardner, welcome to the show. Can you describe what kind of changes you've seen in migration and immigration rights since A, Brexit, B, the 2019 election, and C, coronavirus? But start with Brexit.
Thanks, Zoe. Yeah, wide-ranging question. But I think that we've seen a real shift since Brexit, and that's sort of been encouraged maybe by recent events as well, that people have the importance that people are giving to the issue of migration and its salience has dropped dramatically. I mean, down to levels that haven't been seen since the 90s. And unfortunately, in these measures, always when people care about migration, that's in a bad way. So that's really good. But what's come of that, I think, is something that we also saw back in the 90s, which is that people think migration's sort of under control, whether that's because they feel they've taken back control and free movement's come to an end, or whether it's more led by sort of the press conversation, is debatable. But the focus has very much switched back onto refugees and asylum seekers. And the current Tory government has obviously put asylum seekers very much in their crosshairs, in their sort of theatre of cruelty and display of toughness. And of course, again, this doesn't reflect actually any sort of reality in terms of numbers. Numbers of asylum seekers are relatively low currently. But yeah, I think that the impact of having the sort of rhetoric of having ended free movement and introduced a points-based system has meant that a new target has had to be found, and we've come back around to refugees.
To stop them from getting across the channel, we need to look at the legal framework that we have, all the panoply of laws that an illegal immigrant has at his or her disposal that allow them to stay here, and we need to look at what we can do to change that.
I just want to drill into that a little bit, because as you describe that flip from a focus on asylum seekers to migrants back to asylum seekers, I've seen it happen so many times over the past 30 years, especially under New Labour, actually. Can you describe what political capital a Conservative would be trying to get out of migration and what they'd be trying to get out of asylum seekers? Or are those two things interchangeable in the way they use the rhetoric?
I think in the purpose that they serve for the government and for the Tories, but also actually that they have served definitely for Labour, is identical. Because as I say, it's not based on any reality based in numbers. It's not based on sort of the reality of what kind of leniency of a system that people face. It's simply the use of the foreign other, who is a threat, who this government can show that it's protecting its voter base against, and, you know, protecting the nationalist wealth of the nation, sort of defined us versus them, all of this basic stuff. It's just a different sort of category of other filling that exact same hole that is needed to sort of shore up an element of the political support that they rely on.
I think that aspect of public opinion that you mentioned is really based on a convergence between two different trajectories within the public. Like, one, if you like, is an anti-immigration sentiment, but that believes that immigration has been resolved as a result of Brexit, or that it's now under control and we've taken back control and Brexit finds its sort of resolution of the immigration question. And then the second tendency is obviously much more positive from our perspective, and I think more long term. And that's just a general trend that you see in public opinion, which you might not believe, or we might not believe sometimes, but generally speaking, societies are becoming more liberal and more relaxed about immigration, more tolerant of ethnic minorities. It's just that the politics doesn't always seem like it's moving in that direction.
Definitely, I think that's true. And I think that that is part of what we're seeing. And I think also that definitely, like, more recent events than Brexit, and obviously I'm talking about the pandemic, have also shown something sort of more positive there, which is that when faced with a real threat, as opposed to a sort of imagined or fabricated threat, then people are generally start to care about the things that actually matter. So you look at the salient concerns that have replaced migration, and it's, you know, the NHS and public services and general sort of social cohesion. These are the issues that people are caring about more now. So, yeah, it does sort of show that people don't have time for this rubbish when they're actually facing a threat that's clearly far more real. On the other hand, obviously, there are times when that doesn't happen. And certainly in terms of economic crisis, that's obviously sometimes a bit less positive result. And we are worried about, like, the current post-COVID, maybe I'm just sort of jumping way ahead here, but post-COVID and, you know, the job losses that have already resulted from this pandemic and the likely economic impact, especially in certain key sectors, and what that might do to the conversation around migration as well, if the opportunistic people tend to jump on that and then obviously start saying that migrants are coming for your jobs and all that.
I think on that point, just quickly, like, I think there's two aspects of public opinion as well that are quite closely interrelated. And one is attitudes towards immigration, and another is attitude towards welfare claimants. And I don't think it's a coincidence that at a time when you see very, in historical terms, much more relaxed views and more positive views about immigration, you also see much more support for higher welfare benefits, which is a huge change from the reaction to the financial crisis 10 years ago. And obviously, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, there's a big spike in unemployment. But just because unemployment affects more people, unfortunately, it didn't lead, like, automatically to more people being happy with people on unemployment benefits or thinking that unemployment benefits should go up. But in this crisis, even the Tories feel under sufficient pressure that is quite likely that, well, they've already raised universal credit by 20 quid, and it's quite likely that they'll extend that in the budget on the 8th of March too. And I think these are a sort of overlapping elements of public opinion and political ideology, because they're about sort of kicking the ladder away for the vulnerable, and this idea that you should just get on, and, you know, of course society protects people, but society protects those that deserve protection, and that's the hard-working Britons that build, you know, the nation, that strong nationalist ideology. And I think it can only be positive that there are elements of those ideas, not to exaggerate it or to overplay it, that are being broken up a bit in this crisis.
Yeah, I think that is a fair analysis. I do always love Luke Cooper's and never failing optimism.
Well, he's definitely not seen as the optimist around here.
Zoe is the optimist on the podcast, actually, though it is true that beyond the insane Pollyanna optimism of Zoe Williams, I am, in normal society, also seen as an optimist. Maybe it's just a generally very optimistic podcast.
Maybe that's why it's so great.
Yeah, maybe we should rename it. What I'm interested in right now is that it's bizarre to watch the kind of public discourse around asylum seekers as having totally forgotten that there's any legitimacy at all to seeking asylum. And I remember that as a kind of seeded idea in like the late 90s that suddenly you couldn't say the word asylum seeker without affixing bogus to the beginning of it. But I wonder whether this is something different, and this is a hangover from Windrush, that the whole notion of the hostile environment has left this kind of policy direction where the bureaucracy has to be as faceless as possible. And that's kind of bleeding into the way everybody understands the experience of seeking asylum and or migrating.
Elena, welcome to the show. Do you want to come in on anything we've said so far?
Yes. Well, apart from agreeing with Zoe that you and Zoe are two of the most optimistic people I know and get to speak to about various political developments, I also think that it is quite interesting, this kind of convergence of ideas around migration and people getting more used to, I guess, the idea of migration as long as it's seen as a mass of people contributing rather than a mass of people taking things out of the system. I thought it was quite interesting, the research that came out today, where even in the situation that we've just experienced, even in COVID, people are still kind of looking to view things like job losses as more to do with personal responsibility rather than outside circumstances or indeed government responsibility towards people. So that's 40% of people. So that's 60% in the other direction. That's 60% of people who are willing to admit that there are things beyond personal responsibility that determine your employment status, your ability to access and cover your own needs, basically, and to what extent you depend on society to help you out, at least temporarily.
Even I would be the first to admit that that is a grim statistic, in the simple sense that you have this huge crisis caused by a virus spreading from East Asia to Europe and all over the world, and a massive economic collapse brought about by that virus, shutdown of global economies, and still 40% of people believe that it's the personal responsibility of the individual who has lost their job in this context that they lost their job. I mean, it's a maddening statistic.
I think there's two things here. I think one is people haven't actually seen the full impact of COVID, and especially the impact of COVID with Brexit. So a lot of these economic consequences, yes, many people live through them, but we do still have furlough, we do still have some support schemes. Because a lot of businesses are not currently allowed to open, people don't realize that as soon as they're allowed to open, they're not going to open because they will already be bankrupt. So I think people don't really see yet the extent of the economic hardship that will, you know, follow us after the pandemic and exacerbated by Brexit. So I think that's partly the reason why there's this perceived cruelty, really, in that statistic.
But I also think there's a really strong thing where people are asked these questions and those are, you know, 40% of people blaming others for their own job losses. I swear to God, those are people who aren't in the active job market. So because anybody who's in the active job market can tell perfectly well what the pressures are. So basically, we keep asking people questions that they kind of can't by experience know anything about, and then being horrified when they give really ignorant answers. I feel like it's maybe a bit pointless. It's like asking somebody to, you know, how to do heart surgery. You have to stop asking people to give a view on something that they're not qualified to give a view on.
I cannot agree more, because I think that obviously everybody's entitled to their opinion about migration, and goodness knows we've heard enough about that. But the fact is that especially with migration, and I suppose to an extent with welfare as well, but for some reason, migration seems to be something like we don't ask people to comment really to the same degree on fiscal policy or on housing policy or on, I don't know, like there are so many policies that I just wouldn't feel qualified to call into a radio station and have a rant about how they ought to be doing it. And I don't think anybody should listen to me if I do. But for some reason with migration, people feel like it's a personal experience that they have. And people present it, it's presented in our national conversation as something that everybody's entitled to their opinion on. Fine, yes, they are. But some opinions are based on more knowledge than others. And actually, there are reasons to, like, you know, go back to the whole Brexit thing, but to listen to people who actually have some expertise on the question rather than basing policy. And this is the trap that this Tory government, I think it's very interesting watching Priti Patel squirm, the trap that they've ended up putting themselves into. They've said that they're going to bring out a new sovereign borders bill and they're going to, you know, overhaul everything and make it the tightest and harshest and meanest ever system ever. Just you wait and see. We're going to clear all this up and nobody's going to get in here ever again. But they can't. They've left themselves in a corner where there's very few places left to turn. If they make the immigration system much harsher, they're in danger of doing serious damage to the economy. They already have, obviously, by getting rid of free movement, which they had to do for the exact same reason. If you continue to tell people who have no idea whatsoever how the immigration system works, that you need to make it tighter and tighter, you end up in a situation. I mean, Priti Patel's immigration bill has been pushed back now, potentially to the end of the year, potentially not even, you know, into next year. And we were being threatened with it as soon as the election was over, that it was coming and it was supposed to come, you know, at the end of last year, then it was supposed to come in January. And now we're being told spring, maybe autumn. She doesn't know what she's going to do. It's very difficult to stay within our international legal obligations, even vaguely, which obviously, you know, and I'll probably get to it, but there are ways in which we're already questionably fulfilling our legal obligations, fulfilling the obligations that we absolutely need to from a point of view of economic necessity in terms of migration, and yet tighten up the system any further than Theresa May already did.
So look, you hear this word bandied around a lot by everyone, but maybe you could just detail exactly what it means for us. What is the hostile environment? And this was something that obviously came up a lot around the Windrush crisis. Now, the Windrush crisis has allegedly been resolved. And so does that mean the hostile environment no longer exists?
I want to make several things completely clear. The first is that every policy that existed that caused the Windrush scandal, every single one remains in place in the exact same way. No policy has been changed as a result of the Windrush scandal. Secondly, no, the Windrush scandal is not over. The victims of the Windrush scandal have not received compensation. Many of them have died waiting for compensation, some of them waiting to even be allowed to return to the UK. The Windrush scandal continues as long as its victims have not been given redress, and they haven't. And the policies of the hostile environment remain entirely in place. So the hostile environment is generally understood to be a collection of policies which are aimed at making it extremely difficult to live in the UK, to access basic services, to rent a house, to have a job if you're an undocumented migrant. And the evidence of the Windrush scandal is that it obviously impacts many, many people far beyond undocumented migrants, not only simply migrants who are here legally and within legal visa categories, but also Black and minority ethnic British people. It's part of a culture of fear and denial of services towards people who can be in some way associated with immigration enforcement. And that means putting borders into our everyday life. It means your landlord is required, on pain of fine or even a prison sentence, to check your immigration status. It means your doctors are required to do so. It means that your employer is required to do so. And it creates huge barriers to access to, you know, the most basic needs that all of us have in society, not only for people who are undocumented, but also for anybody who is on the wrong end of a landlord who, instead of learning the complex rules around immigration, decides to only rent to somebody who seems to them to be British. And we all know what that will mean. So the hostile environment has survived entirely intact from the Windrush scandal. And I think this was shown once again yesterday at the time of recording, I don't know what that will mean, probably last week, when Priti Patel gave evidence to the Home Affairs Select Committee and was asked specifically about what changes her department has made since the publication of the Windrush Lessons Learned review, which was getting on for a year ago now. She was almost exactly a year ago. that Wendy Williams published the Windrush Lessons Learned review, which accused the Home Office of having racially insensitive policies that led directly to discrimination and not listening to expert organisations such as JCWI about how, you know, schemes like landlords checking immigration status was bound to lead to racial discrimination. And her response as to what her department has done in that whole year was that there has been some training for Home Office staff on how they write letters communicating things about people's status to them. And that's it. So, yeah, lessons learned. We can draw our own conclusions. In the meantime, obviously, her department is pursuing with a quite distasteful zeal the worst headline they can possibly find on how they're treating refugees and asylum seekers.
Elena, there's quite a lot of uncertainty in the data, but some estimates show hundreds of thousands of migrants, EU and non-EU, leaving the UK in 2020. You've been doing a lot of work on the dangers of EU workers falling through the cracks and becoming illegal when freedom of movement ends. Can you tell us about that? And how does the big exodus affect that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the one kind of overarching point is, as Zoe said, all of these policies that we talk about when we talk about the hostile environment are still in place. And not only are they still in place, they're, you know, eager to be acquainted with the millions of European nationals that live in the UK, both people who already have status and people who don't. Because the real problem is not only that these policies exist and make life very difficult for people who don't have the proper paperwork, it means that people who do have the proper paperwork hear about these things, they read about these things, and they get the idea that these services are not for them anyway because they're not British passport holders and they don't look like what the idea of a British person looks like. So we're seeing people that even though they do have rightful status and legal rights to be in the country and to use services, they're already hesitant about exercising those rights and unclear about what has changed for them. But in terms of the exodus that you're talking about, yeah, I think it's really quite remarkable and very worrying. At least for me, it's very worrying. Maybe some people will welcome it. But there's data that suggests that something like 1.3 million foreign-born nationals have left the UK in 2020. And that's both EEA nationals, but also people from third countries. The majority of these people have left, obviously, because of very uncertain economic situation. So we're seeing, for example, especially EEA nationals overrepresented in industries like hospitality, agriculture, and a few others that have been badly hit by the pandemic and by closures. Now, many people have been offered furlough, but we're talking about low-paid workers that even on full wage were barely making ends meet. When you're offered potentially 70% of that and you are in one of the most dangerous places in the world, given the rate of the COVID spread and the rise in deaths that we were seeing throughout last year and the beginning of this year, it is no wonder that many people will choose a plan B, and a plan B for them will be to go back home where they will be with their family, where they will likely be more safe than staying here, and where they will try and wait it out. The problem in the case of EEA nationals is obviously the transition period ended in the middle of all of this. It ended on the 31st of December last year, and from January the 1st, new rules apply for people coming in to the country for the first time. It also means that people have a lot less certainty about what job awaits them if they do come back. And therefore, people are delaying coming back as much as possible just to minimize the costs to themselves. It's also the case that in Scotland, where I am, for example, you can't come back unless you want to pay £1,750 for a quarantine hotel, because Scotland is quarantining everyone. Now, that may be sensible from public health perspective, but for a low-paid migrant worker, that's impossible. So people are faced with this situation where they have to think, am I going to overstay the 6 months I'm allowed to be out of the country and jeopardize my status? Or am I going to enter into debt potentially just to be able to go back into this country where the pub that I worked in is still closed. The restaurants are still working on home deliveries at minimum capacity, and hundreds of non-essential businesses are still closed. So there is really a big danger that many of the people that have left, of those 1.3 million that I mentioned in the beginning, thinking that this was a temporary measure, might actually end up locked out of returning.
Yeah, and of course, that's the most important point in a way. But I suppose secondarily, I'm just quite scared that the dual effect of this huge economic collapse plus the new immigration policy and the abolition of freedom of movement will permanently, or risks permanently, changing the culture and the cultural economy of a city like London and our other big cities. You know, a third of Londoners born overseas, so much of the cultural diversity and simple levels of economic demand over the last 20 years has been brought to London by EU freedom of movement, young kids from Spain moving to London with no money, working in bars. You know, the new immigration rules will make that much, much harder to achieve. And so you have this scary prospect of, I think it's 4 million, 4.5 million people who are still on the furlough system. When furlough is removed as a policy, like, the scale of unemployment will be staggering, and where that demand is going to come from is really uncertain. And you also have this added effect on top of the economic crisis of losing the immigration-based demand as well, of people not coming back who have left. So I think it's a really dangerous, potentially toxic mix. And to go back to the point that Zoe made earlier, actually, I think it's in those circumstances of really horrible recession that you could certainly see the resurgence of far-right, EDL-like movements on the street and general anti-immigration politics again.
I think a point that's lost on many people, even well-meaning pro-migration people who look at the information on settled status, for example, about EEA nationals, they look at the numbers, they think, well, millions of people have applied, and this seems to be a very generous system, and it is compared to anything else that the Home Office has in place. The settled status scheme is a song compared to any other immigration regulations we've got. But the problem is that the way EEA nationals have been migrating to the UK is not exactly the same. People have come, as you said, on a whim, with very little preparation, very little kind of plans in their head about what they're going to do and how long they're going to stay. They've been much more transient. That doesn't make them any less valuable, either culturally or socially or economically. But people have used freedom of movement in a different way than this normal perception of immigration as someone who comes here to settle here, make their life here forever. And I think that is no longer possible. This is no longer possible, and people are suffering all sorts of consequences and will be suffering all sorts of consequences as a result of it. And also something that I didn't even think about before, not seriously anyway, before Brexit actually happened and the transition period actually happened. We hear a lot about the impact on various industries and various businesses, but we hear very little about the actual economy that migrant communities have created for themselves in the UK. And that is also severely impacted at the moment. So we are seeing not just people losing their jobs, but people losing their businesses that they've set up here. And we're talking about services provided by migrants for migrants that have been operating very successfully for a number of years and are suddenly made completely inoperable, mostly by Brexit, but also the added negative impact of COVID, obviously. Things like, you know, transportation services and shipping and deliveries of people's favorite foods and all sorts of things like that seem minimal on the face of it, but actually support a real thriving economy in various communities.
Zoe, what do you think of the whole border closure issue? I mean, it obviously is practically like a huge headache for people that Elena was describing, but do you think it's a good idea in principle?
I think that the terms that are being used for it, first of all, border closure, no, I'm not in favour of border closure. I think you're using border closure in the way others have been, and what we mean are travel restrictions. Travel restrictions in the time of global pandemic are probably completely sensible. I'm not in any way an expert on, you know, the exact detail of what they should be, but I think that they make perfect sense to have restrictions on people's travel at a time when obviously moving about is a risk of spreading a deadly disease. Border closures is the language that has been used to talk about it, and that's something that is completely unrealistic, and I think lends itself to a really dangerous sort of extrapolation from what is a sensible conversation about controlling the spread of a disease to, you know, a sort of dangerous framing of it in terms of sort of a foreign threat and something that migrants bring, and also in a way that doesn't consider all the various ways in which our border needs to be permeable. Now, many people making, you know, holidays and other sort of like leisure travel, yeah, I agree, restrictions on that and quarantine especially, obviously, potentially at people's own cost, might be reasonable in those cases. But there is a significant amount of border crossing that is essential travel, and that includes both sort of products and goods that is brought into our country that we don't otherwise have here. And again, that's not an area I'm an expert on. But there are forms of migration that are essential. That's obviously in terms of refugee journeys, where border closures as a framing is completely the wrong approach to protecting us and migrants from COVID in the context of essential refugee journeys. But also, I think it would be positive to have a conversation about this that acknowledges experiences of the kind of people that Elena was just talking about. People who have been separated from families or separated from the home they made if they may have returned from their families, people for whom travel is not just holiday to the sun or to go skiing, but is actually, you know, the difference between being there when your sick parent passes away or not being able to be there because you live in a different country. And that kind of thing means a great deal to different people who have internationally based lives. And I think we've all made incredible sacrifices, and many people have not seen their families throughout this year. And so maybe we should take from that a bit more of an understanding of what it means to be separated from your family for long periods of time. I mean, refugees who are unable to return to where their family is from often go years without seeing their family or just lose track of their family entirely in the course of their journey. So I would hope that instead of talking about some kind of nationalized protection from COVID, we could look at a more truly global response. So like a pandemic is by definition a global issue. And I think that by talking more about widespread sharing of the vaccine across borders and protection on and consideration for the people who've been separated across borders, and allowance in our language for the essential travel that does take place across borders, are all important parts of the discussion of what is a safe travel policy during this pandemic.
Yeah, obviously the amounts of money that British citizens or residents in the UK are being asked to pay just to return is just insane, as Elena was saying earlier, like £1,750. I mean, I'd think that it would be reasonable for them to pay something, but just that amount of money is just colossal and makes it almost like a form of economic apartheid, basically. If you're wealthy, you'll be able to afford that. And if you're a poor migrant worker who has residency in the UK and went home for a funeral and has to come back, then that's just an incredible amount of money to have to pay that would inevitably lead you in debt. But Zoe, I wanted to ask you about that interesting piece that you wrote in The Independent about the hotel quarantine issue and like the rights of the migrant workers in the hotels. And I think you pointed out something that has been very overlooked in the whole debate.
I think it's very interesting that exactly as you say, we've sort of set up a quarantine system that means that only the wealthy can even consider travel. But the responsibility for making sure that quarantine actually keeps us all safe has been placed once again on the shoulders of low-paid workers in the hospitality industry. Now, we know that the hospitality industry, first of all, is an area with high levels of national minimum wage contract or, you know, underpayment of the national minimum wage. We know that there's a great deal of agency work, a great deal of zero-hours contracts, a great deal of exploitation, unpaid overtime. You know, these are problems that impact all workers in the hospitality industry. But the hospitality industry is the industry in the UK which employs the greatest proportion of migrant workers. I think it's at 30% of the workforce migrants in the hospitality industry. And as we've sort of touched upon already, and as is really obvious, at the current time, the hospitality industry has taken a major hit. So these quarantine hotels is like one very small area where jobs are still available or are being made available in the hospitality industry. But the people who work in those hotels, you know, whether they're hotel staff, whether they're security staff, or whether they're cleaners or caterers, you know, they're going to be a significant proportion of them who are migrant workers. So along with the entire workforce, they will be subject to very likely low pay. But migrant workers in those conditions are almost certainly going to be subject to no recourse to public funds conditions as well. Which means that basically, if all you're entitled to is statutory sick pay, and you're a migrant who isn't entitled to claim any benefits, and therefore will find it probably all the more difficult, even though, again, for everybody, it's difficult to claim the isolation payment, one-off £500 payment that the government has supposedly made available for people who need to isolate. The reality is that people in these circumstances can't survive on just statutory sick pay, or in some cases, not even that. We found our research showing that migrant workers in exploitative conditions are not even being offered statutory sick pay. They can't take time off work. That means that the entire quarantine system is at risk of being completely pointless if the staff in those hotels are not able to keep themselves safe and have to continue going into work, even though they may have been exposed to the virus or they may be displaying symptoms. You know, people can't isolate for 10 days on, you know, fresh air and goodwill. They need to have decent sick pay. This reflects how throughout the entire pandemic, the actual risk taken, you know, somebody like me and most people working in professional jobs in the country have been able to stay at home. And the burden of risk has been placed on people who are the least able to then take time off if they are exposed to the virus. And that's, I think, what has been one of the key things that has made getting the virus under control so much more difficult and so much more of a long and drawn out and painful process. And so many more deaths will have happened quite simply because workers who are low paid simply cannot support their families for 10 days on statutory sick pay. And if on top of that, you have no recourse to public funds, that means that you are unable to receive universal credit for a start. You're unable to receive housing benefit, child benefit, disability support, personal independence payments, a whole raft of all the key benefits that support people in low-paid jobs in this country. Because let's not forget, most people who are living in poverty and most people who are supported by welfare in this country are in work, right? They're just in low-paid work. If you're a migrant in that sort of low-paid work, you are not entitled to those benefits. That means you're more likely to be at risk of destitution. And if you have to take time off sick, then that might be the difference between being able to put food on your children's table or not. And people can't make that kind of choices. We can't ask them to. You know, we're never going to get the virus under control as long as we're forcing people into making those impossible choices.
Exactly. Grim, though. Elena, anything to add here?
Yeah, I was going to say, apart from the general frustration I personally have because I've been unable to travel, I've missed sad family events in all of this, but I'm actually enraged about how these mandatory quarantine conditions are imposed on travelers and the way this is spoken of when we've not really seen the same pressure put on the government to make even the most basic preparations for people to be able to isolate securely at home, you know, people who catch it in the community, who are unable to isolate in their own homes, because as Zoe said, statutory sick pay does not cover their basic expenses. So this has remained unchanged for over a year, but a wide variety of reasons that lead people to maybe have to travel are all lumped together as, I don't know, some extravagance that everyone is made to pay through their nose for. So I think that's my biggest objection to the plan as it has been put in place.
Can I also just add another note? This impacts people in low pay who only have access to statutory sick pay. I mean, obviously, we've all seen the stats, which are truly horrifying, that show that Black and brown and minority ethnic people have suffered by far the most hardship during this pandemic, both in terms of deaths, but also sort of in terms of access to the vaccine. Rates of vaccination among ethnic minorities are lower than among the white population, even after we've seen that Black and brown people are suffering more and more likely to have suffered from COVID. And there's a whole host of factors that are contributing to that. But one of the things
is certainly the quality of housing. And we know that there are huge disparities in the quality of housing along ethnic lines in this country. And we know that there's massive racism in the housing market as a whole. But because the government doesn't collect data on the immigration status of either victims of COVID or other issues as well, it's very hard to point out exactly how much of the additional impact on minority communities has been caused by immigration policies. But we can be pretty sure that there is at least some significant impact from certain policies. So we know that ethnic minority people are more likely to live in poorer quality housing, in urban centres with poor access to green space, more crowding, you know, more damp, more exploitative landlords. And we also know that people with no recourse to public funds don't have access to housing benefit. And we know that from research that we've done at JCWI, we did a survey and 50% of respondents with no recourse to public funds said that if they or somebody who lived in their household needed to self-isolate either because they'd come into contact with somebody or because they had symptoms themselves, in their household, it would be impossible to isolate because of crowded shared accommodation. So even when we've got a society that places people at particularly increased risk in the workplace and doesn't provide them with the financial ability to isolate, they also, the inequalities in our society that have placed people in poorer quality housing, so that even if they could isolate, even if they had the money in order to isolate, they're actually in housing where it's impossible to do so. So we've created a situation where, I mean, it's truly dystopian how COVID has really, really ravaged through communities who are already disadvantaged in numerous ways. And it's utterly shameful that this has happened, you know, in a year where our Home Secretary has stood up and said that she thought that the Black Lives Matter protests were dreadful. And we know that her immigration policies are contributing to a greater death toll from a global pandemic among Black British communities. It's completely disgusting.
I mean, I don't know if there's any positive note we can end on.
My God, you know, you see, you're the positive one. I can't do it. I'm always a downer.
I was actually just thinking about that. I don't think there is a positive that we can end on.
That concludes this episode. There's no extra time this week as a special one-off. We released the whole podcast in full. Usually members of Another Europe get access to extra material as a benefit of the campaign. We'd still, of course, urge you to sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join us at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.